Beginning with their second semester of freshman year, Wyoming Catholic College students begin a year studying Euclidean geometry. Students prepare for each class carefully because they need to wait to be called to the board to demonstrate one of this week's propositions. This is Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast, The After Dinner Scholar, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Euclid wrote his Elements in about 300 BC, beginning with the definition of a point and a line. He constructed the geometrical principles we still use today. And our students work their way from, quote, on a given finite straight line to construct an equilateral triangle, to construct an icosahedron and comprehend it in a sphere, to Book 12, Proposition 17, popularly known as the Death Star. Why Euclid? Our website puts it this way. Euclid's Elements is the foundational text of mathematics in Western civilization. I asked Dr. Henry Zepeda why that's the case.
It's just a historical fact that throughout the last 2,000 years, it is the most important mathematical textbook, especially for beginners of geometry, especially. It has been printed thousands of times, or at least 8,000 times, and there have been just lots and lots of translations, from the middle of the Middle Ages until about 100 years ago. Anybody who went to university or who studied, who was an advanced student, would have studied at least some of the elements of Euclid.
And it's the gateway to all other math?
Yeah, I think that's why it's called the Elements, is that it provides a really good foundation. And that actually is why it's, I think, the reason it's been such an influential text, is that it's a really good foundation for the rest of mathematics. Or if you're going to only do a little bit of mathematics, it's a great book to use, even if you're not going to go and do further math. And I think that's the reason that it is such a good book, is that it is arranged very well, and its content is also interesting content. So it's arranged very deductively. So he lays out some definitions, postulates, and common notions, and then just slowly reasons out what he can from those. And then once he has conclusions, he can use those in further arguments. And in not too long of a time, he's doing very complex things, like showing that the ratio of spheres to each other is the triplicate ratio of their respective diameters, or that we can make an icosahedron, a 20-faced perfect solid that fits inside of a sphere. So that method works out very well for him, and also the content gets him to a lot of really interesting results in plane geometry, going through things like the Pythagorean theorem, then in proportion theory, putting together a lot of the tools that you need in other mathematics, and then getting to a kind of proof called a proof by the method of exhaustion, and then getting to the perfect solids, which are these, well, some of them at least are very complex, but they're solids that where each face is regular, an equilateral and equal angular polygon, and you have all the faces of this solid the same. So something like a pyramid with a triangular base, you could make that out of equilateral triangles. Right, so something like that, or cube. And this is an interesting case where there are limits in mathematics. He makes these and shows that there are only five. And this is one of the relatively rare instances where you have that sort of limitation in mathematics, where there are only a certain number of things. Usually you can keep adding a line or adding a number or multiply something and get more and more and more in mathematics ad infinitum. But here there's a case where you can't. It also gives the book a nice ending point.
Now, I remember way back when I was a freshman in high school, doing, I guess, sort of a dumbed-down version of Euclid's geometry. The elements, though, include more than geometry. Is that correct?
Proportion theory that's in there is, in a way, outside of geometry. It's about magnitude, but it's not paying attention to a line or a square or a circle. So I think that is, in a way, outside of geometry. But there are a number of books in there. Even though it's often called The Elements of Geometry, 3 of the 13 books are actually on numbers. And he treats numbers in a very generalized way or universal way, where he never actually says anything about the number 2 or the number 3. Instead, he talks about, if we have a number and it's an even number, let's call it number AB, then he'll prove something about it. But it's... So it follows that universal mode that he's working in for the rest of it. Yeah, but it is not geometry. It is arithmetic. We actually don't do that with our students for questions of time. Mostly, I think we skip over those, and they learn the geometry in there.
Well, it's just amazing that 3,000 years since Euclid or thereabouts?
Oh, a little over 2,000.
A little over 2,000. Yeah, yeah. But we're still studying the same stuff.
Yeah, yeah. This is universal knowledge. It's timeless. So even though we have more advanced techniques, more advanced mathematical tools that will allow us to go further, what he's doing follows just the way humans reason. It also is it's a very nice science where we're able to reason logically, but also have pictures to help out our imagination at the same time. We still have imaginations and we still have reason. So there's no reason why 2,000 years later we look at Euclid and think that it's outdated or something.
Mm-hmm. Now, aren't some of the propositions kind of obvious? I mean, I remember one saying that, you know, a line passing through a circle hits the circle twice. Well, yeah. What difference does it make that we prove that?
We want to prove things in order to see the reason why. Aristotle talks about the reason the fact of something, and then the reason fact, where you see the reason behind it. And one is just a deeper kind of knowledge. You can know something's true, but to know the reason behind it just makes your understanding so much better. So that's what we're trying to do here. We start out with these very basic principles, and then everything else is seen as a consequence of those principles.
That's one of the things I remember about geometry. You had to do it every night, because if you missed something, you are missing one of the steps that's going to get you to the next place.
Yes, yes. A lot of the arguments, especially further on, they're relying upon all of the work you've put in up to that point. You can't really open up Euclid and look at something at the end, or at least to really understand it, you have to work through it. And it's a lot of work. The students spend a semester and a half going through Euclid, and this is a class that usually requires a lot of study time. Where there are some very long proofs where students have to learn 5 pages of an argument and be able to replicate that without notes up in front of the class. And they often are called at random, so they all have to know it.
Wow. Now, Euclidean geometry is the way we describe the physical world most of the time, correct? But there's also something called non-Euclidean geometry. In 25 words or less, what exactly is that?
Yeah, in Euclidean geometry, we have the parallel postulate. One of our principles is that if we have two lines with a line falling across them, and on one side of that line, the angles that are made add up to less than 2 rights, those lines eventually will meet over on that side somewhere. Now, Euclidean geometry is any kind of geometry that takes the other Euclidean axioms and but then replaces this parallel postulate with something else.
Oh, this is non-Euclidean geometry.
Non-Euclidean geometry does that, yeah. So what non-Euclidean geometry does is replace, it's not a rejection of all of Euclid, it's a rejection of this one postulate and a replacement of it with something else. And this leads to interesting results. So for example, you could have one where, as I said, you have lines with a line crossing them. The angles that are made on one side are less than two right angles, but yet you extend those lines and they never meet. Or you could have multiple ways, so you could have multiple ways of having parallel lines or lines that never meet. You could, another way of thinking of it is that you could have a line, you could have a point off of that line, and through that point, you could draw not just one parallel line, but several. Several lines that are in the same plane as your original line, but yet don't meet it. And this, when you deny that postulate, you end up with geometries where things, well, a lot of the consequences are affected. So in Euclidean geometry, the angles inside of a triangle are always going to add up to two right angles, to 180 degrees. In non-Euclidean geometry, that's not true. Depending on what postulate you use to replace Euclid's parallel postulate, you're either going to get those angles adding up to less than two right angles or more than two right angles. A geometry where you can have a triangle where all of the angles are right angles. Hard to imagine, right?
Yeah, a little hard to imagine. Is that useful in some way? Or?
Yeah, it is. It describes some situations. You can have that sort of triangle on the surface of a sphere.
Ah.
And then it turns out, and this is what our seniors are about to get to in their science class, where we're studying relativity. In general relativity, they talked about space-time being curved around gravitational fields. You basically have straight line. The geometry does not actually work in the way Euclid describes. Yeah. So actually, we are going to get to some ways in which actually non-Euclidean geometry will explain some of the way the physical world acts. Although in most situations, Euclidean geometry is going to be what we use to explain what's going on.
Right. The square of the hypotenuse will still equal the sum of the squares of the two adjacent sides.
Yes.
Now, way back when I was studying Euclidean geometry, I took it more than anything else as a sort of an exercise in logical reasoning. I mean, it was this sort of fun little game that I was playing. But it's more than that for our students who are called to demonstrate the props in the class. What do most of them take away from the math?
Yeah, so I think that's actually one big result that the class has on, that the course has on our students, is that they actually get a lot of practice in learning arguments and following arguments and actually making those arguments their own by learning them well enough that they can get up there and do them without any notes or any help from other students. It's nice for them to see the logic that they've studied theoretically really put into practice and see a lot of pretty rigorous logical argumentation. So that's something that's, I think, is a very good thing about our study of Euclid here. But I don't think that's even the primary goal of what we're doing here. We're trying to study being in all its different ways of existing and trying to get a beginning in all different kinds of knowledge. And one of the main types of knowing is knowing things mathematically, is looking at quantity, basically, and reasoning about it. So this is, I think we see the goal of having our students learn some basic things and have a good foundation in mathematical thinking is part of a complete liberal arts education.
Poet Edna St. Vincent Millay wrote, "Euclid alone has looked on beauty bare. Fortunate they who, though once only and then but far away, have heard her massive sandal set on stone." If you know high school seniors who might be interested in studying Euclid and the rest of the integrated curriculum here at Wyoming Catholic College, you might encourage them to apply to be part of Founders Scholarship Weekend and perhaps win a full tuition scholarship to the college. The Fall Founders Weekend has been and gone, but space is still available here in Lander, March 11th through 14th, and again April 8th through 11th. For more information and to apply, visit the college website, wyomingcatholic.edu, and click the Admissions tab. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.